The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Today we have something a little bit different. This is, of course, a podcast devoted to movies, and the subject we have for this episode is actually a television special, but it comes from a movie studio, UPA, and its 50th anniversary is nigh, and it's something that I dearly love, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol. We're going to be talking with Darryl Van Sitters, who wrote the definitive book on the making of that great special. And it is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. I bought Darryl's book the second I knew about it. And in fact, I knew that it was being written for quite a while before that. And I was constantly bugging him with, are you done yet? Are you finished yet? Is it ready yet? Is it going to come out yet? And then when it finally did, I grabbed it and I ate it like candy. It was wonderful. And I take it down regularly and look through it. And Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol itself is something that has literally been part of virtually my entire life. Can I say literally and virtually in the same sentence? I just did. I saw it when I was a child. And as I I will explain again in wrenching detail, there has never been a Christmas since the first time I saw it that I have not enjoyed it again and again and again. Who knows how many times I've seen this thing? I could recite it for you right now. In fact, I think I will. Settle back and let me start. It's a great special, and it is partly great because despite what you would think coming in, that it's Mr. Magoo, who's a comic character known for being nearsighted, as I'm sure you all remember, but he is not what you would think the obvious choice to play a classical character in a great adaptation of a great story, unless he was spoofing it. And so I think the normal expectation for anybody who was old enough to have such expectations, when I first saw it, I was not, but that it was going to be a comedy version of A Christmas Carol, that it was going to be a spoof of some kind. And Lord knows, A Christmas Carol has been spoofed by virtually every comedy TV show that was ever made, and a few dramatic TV shows. It has been parodied and redone and reinterpreted and stretched sideways in this way and that more than any other story I can think of. But if you think that Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol is going to be a comedy or a spoof, you will be disabused of that very soon. It does have a comic opening and closing with Mr. Magoo heading for the theater where he's going to play Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. And he sings a song about being back on Broadway. And there's plenty of his nearsighted hijinks where he sees something and completely misinterprets what he's looking at. And there's more of that at the very end in the tag. But once it gets into the play itself, it is not a comedy. There are light moments and there are a few funny moments. There's one comic song. But by and large, this is a really heartfelt and lovely adaptation of this classic story. And I think one of the things that makes it so enduringly wonderful is the songs by Bob Merrill and Julie Stein. Now, they were writing these songs at the same time that they were writing Funny Girl. And these guys were at the top of the pecking order. And even now, thinking back on what TV world was like, it seems incredible that these guys who were making a limited animation cartoon special for a one-hour special for TV would go to the top songwriters in the field for a real Broadway-sounding score. And also, Walter Scharf, who did the incidental music, was one of the greats. And his arrangements and his underscoring in this film are wonderful and memorable. So this is a terrific film. And the reason we bring it up right now is that on December 18th, it will mark the 50th anniversary of the first airing of Magoo's Christmas Carol on television. And I hear tell that NBC is going to be showing it for the first time on network in decades on December 22nd, I believe. You might want to check your local listings. I'm flying by the seat of my pants on this one. But it's somewhere around there. 21st, 22nd. And I think Daryl says it within the body of this. I should really listen to these interviews again before I start talking, shouldn't I? But they're almost certainly going to have to edit it to play it on network TV. But the fact that it will be on network TV again is a really cool thing. And I hope it'll introduce it to a lot of people who have never seen it before. In the meantime, there's a Blu-ray out that is just stunningly beautiful. The color design in this thing is spectacular. So anyway, I have gone on long enough, and we should go right to the guy who knows all and sees all when it comes to Magoo's Christmas Carol, Mr. Daryl Van Sitters. So I will see you on the other side. First of all, I'm sure that you came to cartoons basically the same way I did. Television, that just watching TV in the afternoons, or were you
interested as a kid? Oh, I was always interested as a kid, but, you know, growing up in the 50s and 60s, that's the way you saw cartoons. It was very rare that you'd see them in the theaters even at that point. So it was always a delight when you saw them that way. But, most of my animation experience came through television.
What were your favorites at the time when you were first becoming aware of cartoons?
Rocky and Bullwinkle, all the Bugs Bunny and Warner Brothers cartoons. I remember being enamored of The Alvin Show just because it was kind of amazing when you have something on prime time. The Flintstones was on prime time. That kind of stuff was kind of amazing. Those were some of the early influences.
Yeah, I loved the Warner Brothers stuff very much. What I always loved about that was it always seemed like there was something that I wasn't getting. There was always a joke just beyond me. And as a kid, that was very attractive to me.
And I think for a lot of kids it is because it's you want to learn more. And yeah. Nowadays they try to explain everything to you or keep anything that might be like that off the table, which is kind of dumbing it down. You know, before you'd have to, well, what's that all about? And then you'd go learn, oh, there was these shortages in World War II, for example, or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly. I remember being a kid and seeing a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and there was a joke about Meatless Friday. And I thought, what in the world?
Yeah.
What is that? But someday I found out about that.
Yes.
So it was fine.
Or why were white wall tires so interesting to people, you know?
White wall tires were interesting to a lot of cartoon characters.
They were.
Yeah. In Tex Avery, all the wolves loved their tires.
The white wall tires, yep.
When did you start deciding that you could be in the biz yourself? Because a lot of us loved cartoons, but not that many of us decided to go into it as a business.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know that there's ever a moment where I thought, hey, I could make money at this, which is a good thing because here I am all these years later. I'm still not making money at it. I just was interested in it, and I was given a book on commercial art techniques, and one of them had animation in it. That looked fascinating to me, and I started reading. I mean, at the time, there were probably 4, maybe 5 books on animation compared to the hundreds that there are now. And I wanted to learn more, and I was lucky enough to have been living in a town where there was a commercial animation studio. And I went there and applied for a job as a cell painter at minimum wage, $1.65 an hour at the time. And I learned the business that way. I mean, really starting at the very bottom and learning how it was all done. And I happened to meet an animator there. And one thing led to another. I heard about California Institute of the Arts, which was just starting up its Disney animation program. And I came out in the first year and been in the business ever since.
Did you have an affinity for Disney cartoons, or was that just happened to be
what CalArts was affiliated with.
Yeah, and you know, if you're going to learn, why not learn the Disney way? Because it was, I mean, technically the best of the bunch. My own leanings were more towards Warner Brothers, and I didn't even know about MGM at the time, other than I'd seen Tom and Jerry's, but I'd never heard of Tex Avery until I came out here. So it was fascinating to see all of that kind of stuff, and the whole world opened up in front of me that there was not just the Disney stuff, there was the Warner Brothers, and there was Tom and Jerry and Tex Avery, and there was so much out there. It was fascinating to me.
And living out here, you must have had a certain amount of access to those guys. I mean, Chuck Jones and
we
all
did.
Those guys were out here.
Yeah, they were out here, and it seemed crazy to me that we weren't taking advantage of the resource. We had this program, and through the animation program, they would bring up Disney people to talk to us. And I thought, why not bring up more people to talk to us? Because there's a big, wide range out there, and most of them were still alive at the time. So I just started writing letters to the union and said, please forward. And we got some people up there that I would never have expected. Like Mike Maltese came up.
Wow.
Or Maurice Noble. Holy cow, this is amazing. You know, you can write a letter to these people and they'll come talk to you.
They're probably glad to do it as well. I mean,
I think they were. I think a lot of those people were just glad that people were remembering them, you know.
Yeah. I met Chuck Jones on, I'd say, half a dozen occasions. And at least 3 years was at Telluride when he would always give an animation show at Telluride and then do a Q&A afterwards.
Yeah.
And every year it became my special thing for myself to wait outside, and he would always just come out by himself and to walk back into town. And so I would always just get with him and start asking him questions that would not have anything to do with the general audience kind of questions.
Right.
But, always interested in the music and all those kind of things. And so I always had these long, involved conversations with him once a year for 3 years running, and it was just a highlight. But he loved to talk about animation with people.
Yeah.
And I got that impression from others who knew him. So I'm sure all those guys did.
They were. Couldn't.
Yeah.
And the great thing about talking to people in animation is they don't come with a posse.
Yeah.
You can actually talk to them.
Yeah, I've always been so jealous. I didn't come to live in California till the early 90s. So I missed a lot of people. But I knew people who knew Tex Avery. And to me, living at that time in Chicago, I thought, that's like magic. I mean, how could you know Tex Avery? This is
I know, because now he's a legend.
Yeah.
At the time, he was just a guy.
Yeah. But to me, at a distance, he was a legend.
Yeah, of course.
And I was thinking, if you were out here, sure, you could probably just go to get with him and talk with him.
Yep.
Just amazing.
Yep.
So you graduated CalArts?
I did. I had 1 year of school prior to that, and I was the very first graduate of the program. I got out in 3 years. Other people ahead of me got out in 2 years, but they weren't graduates. People like John Musker and Brad Bird went straight to Disney after 2 years of school there.
Was that ever an option for you? Did you want to go to Disney?
I did, but you kind of had to be asked.
Ah.
And once I graduated, I was asked. But it was an amazing group in those first 2 years. I mean, they've turned out a lot of great talent there, but there was an amazing group in those first 2 years. You know, like I said, Brad Bird was there, John Lasseter, John Musker, Jerry Reese. And then in the second year, there was Tim Burton and Chris Buck and Mike Giamma, all these people who've gone on to have pretty nice careers.
Whatever happened to those guys?
Look them up on IMDb. See, yeah. See what you can find.
Yeah, see if there's something they could possibly did. But, now, did what I've always been interested in terms of UPA, and we're slowly getting over to Mr. Magoo, that UPA was in some ways the anti-Disney, weren't they, in terms of coming up with a technique that was not the realistic, lush Disney animation? Because wasn't that kind of the impetus for what they were doing at UPA?
Yeah, they were going out of their way to be the anti-Disney. I mean, they really did not like where they'd come from, and which is strange because they got their training there. But they did not much care for the Disney method of telling stories. And so they went out of their way. They came up with, you know, they wanted to look to other influences rather than, kind of that turn of the century illustration style. And they were aggressively trying not to duplicate reality, whereas Walt was doing everything he can to get closer to reality with hand-drawn animation. And it just the chasm between the two probably couldn't have been wider. And there's a lot to be said for both methods, you know. I mean, there was some great stuff done at UPA. There was some great stuff done at Disney. Some of the story work done at UPA was on the weak side. It was more about the visuals than oftentimes it was about the storytelling. So they're fascinating to look at it on a visual level, but some of them are just kind of lie there, you know, because there's just not much story going on there, yeah. Or even being funny. You know, they weren't really about funny. They were about being artists.
But even Disney took the bait after a while and started animating in that style.
It did. Like, you know, Ward Kimball ran with it on Toot, Whistle, Plunk, and Boom. Yeah. And then there was even some influence between what UPA was doing and what Ronald Searle was doing in 101 Dalmatians,
sure.
Which is really one of the most sophisticated pictures they ever did. But in both cases, Walt wasn't his ball of wax. He was not particularly happy with either one of those, but he accepted them.
Yeah, 101 Dalmatians was the first Disney feature that didn't really look like that realistic style. And they used a new Xerox process, too.
Yeah, the Xerox process. And the styling just looked – it's heads and tails above anything they did prior to that, and which is not to say the others weren't sophisticated, but there was something about this approach that really elevated it. Yeah. Maybe it was because it was set in contemporary times, too.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's just a severe change in point of view because Disney – I mean – God knows, I think Pinocchio is a brilliant film and Bambi is incredibly beautiful to look at. But they are trying to craft the world in extremely realistic terms, except for, the fantasy elements of the story.
Right.
But everything, you know, every table in Pinocchio is rock solid and oak with grain. And
heavily rendered.
Yeah, and... And UPA was, it was modern. It was shapes and bright colors and one of the things I love about Magoo, which we'll, you know, I was just watching his first film just a couple of weeks ago, and he sprang pretty fully loaded into cartoons. I mean, he changed over the years, but he was pretty much himself. Tell me a little bit about the origin of Magoo as a character.
Well, he got his start in Ragtime Bear. And originally, I think the cartoon was really written around the bear. It just happened to have this crotchety old man and his nephew who was wearing a big, heavy fur coat, which could be mistaken for the bear if you can't see well.
Sure.
And if you look at, you know, the original model sheet for it, it's all three characters are on that model sheet, and they all get the same amount of attention. It's clear they didn't say, you know what, we're going to make a star out of this old man. But he caught on, and between Jim Backus's characterization and what they did, was Millard Kaufman wrote it and John Hubley directed, between all three of them, it took on a life of its own. And then the second film, I mean, his design evolves, but it evolves pretty quickly in those first few films. And he pretty much becomes the look that we're used to seeing over a very short amount of time, unlike other characters like Bugs Bunny, which took a few more years to evolve. But the character as a personality is pretty fully formed right off the bat. They do soften him later. He's not quite as rigid and quite as... difficult to deal with as he is in that first one, but there's some wonderfully loony animation of him as a crotchety old man in that first one.
Yeah, Ragtime Bear is one of the funniest Magoo cartoons, I think, because as you say, he's not softened, and also the shtick takes over eventually in Magoo, that the blindness or the nearsightedness.
The nearsightedness, yeah.
And... it's one of those things that how many things can he
mistake
for something else? But at that time, when it was fresh out of the gate, it was very funny.
Yeah, it was, and it was unusual too because he was a human character at the time. It was mostly about talking animals, you know, that were stand-ins for human beings. But you very seldom actually had a human being playing a starring role.
Now, Magoo being the kind of character that he was. It's really interesting to me that when they decided to make this version of A Christmas Carol, that he was chosen. I mean, in some ways, I guess it's logical because crotchety old guy, Scrooge, it does make sense. But it doesn't. I'm not sure that I would have thought of it if I had been around 50 years ago to think about it.
I agree. It is an odd choice, and you have to go back and really put yourself in the context of the time. Nobody else had just taken an established character and slapped him into a classic story. That was really a huge leap. It doesn't seem like a big leap now because everybody and his brother has been in an animated version or a live version of A Christmas Carol.
Sure.
But at the time, taking an established character and putting him in a starring role in a classic film, that's a huge leap of faith. And it's amazing, one, that it was proposed, and two, that it was accepted, and three, that it worked.
Well, I think one of the most amazing things about it is that once they decided to do it, they decided to play it pretty straight. And to me, I think that's one of the things. It's been a Christmas tradition my entire life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, I watched it on TV for the first few years that they reran it. I recorded it with an audio recorder. So for the Christmases that I didn't have access to it, I would listen to the soundtrack of it. Then eventually I got a 16-millimeter print of it. And then I got a video cassette of it. And then I got a DVD of it. Now I have a Blu-ray of it.
I'm with you.
but I have never gone to Christmas, maybe ever, without watching it.
Yeah.
But certainly for years and years and years and years and years. And I think one of the reasons for that is that it's so moving. Not that it's not that it's a comedy. It's not that it's it makes me laugh, although there are funny things in it. But that it's so serious and moving. And
it has heart.
Yeah, it really does. And the songs, I mean, it's... But let's... there might be somebody listening who hasn't read your book on the making of Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Probably a lot.
I can't imagine that's true. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
Highly recommend it to everybody. But take us through the process. When did this first spring up as an idea?
Well, you know, it had been in the back of my head for a long time. I kept saying, why is everybody writing books about these other specials and leaving out the first one? You know, where's that book on the making of Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol? Because there would have been one. I mean, Lee Mendelsohn had done one on the Charlie Brown Christmas, and Rick Goldschmidt had done one on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And I said, well, okay, there's two left. There's The Grinch and there's Mr. Magoo. The Grinch still hasn't been written. But it just seemed like a hole there, but it wasn't. Well, I didn't say, you know what, I'm going to go write a book to fill that hole. One thing led to another, and decided to ask looked up, you know, some of the artists who were still living, and there weren't a lot, I went with a friend and we went to interview this one background painter who had worked on the show. And I set up my little digital recorder there. I had all my questions. I had all my visual materials. Got everything prepped. We sat down right in front of him. I said, okay, so tell me what you remember about working on Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol. And he looked at all the material and looked at me and he said, I don't remember that film at all. And I went, no, wrong answer.
Good start.
Yeah. But I'm still in touch with him, and I jokingly say, you are the one that actually caused this book to be written because you didn't remember anything, so I had to go ask a bunch of other people. And in asking a bunch of other people, one thing led to another, and because of something wonderful called the Internet, you can contact a lot of people very quickly. And I happened to find that the producer, Lior Gell, his son, had written a review on Amazon. And I thought, well, let's see if this works. And so I contacted him through his review on Amazon. This doctor in Kentucky at the time, and he wrote back to me. And he said, you know, you should talk to my mom. She lives in Burbank. I went, oh, that's excellent because I live in Glendale. So I went and talked to his mom, Lior Gell, also interestingly named Lior Gell, but L-E-A instead of L-E-E. And she had this letter from Richard Rogers. Apparently Lee had approached Richard Rogers, and he eventually turned them down. I said, oh, you're kidding. That's an amazing story. And then, oh, yeah, we approached Frank Lesser. You're kidding. And then right in Forrest, oh, you're out of, this is unbelievable. And then but Stein and Merrill got it. And you go, this is just before they did Funny Girl. I mean, they were at the peak. And they wrote this special that hardly anybody remembers now. And you go, this is too amazing a story for this to just kind of be lost like this. So it was after talking to Lee that the book really started to take off. And I talked to everybody. I literally found everybody who was still around and talked to them and put the pieces together. Even found, amazingly enough, there were some articles written at the time and some interviews with Stein and Merrill, and was able to put together this thing. It was a big detective work, piece of detective work to put this thing together. But I thought, this is a story that needs to be told. I don't know how many people will be dying to hear this, but I think it's a story that has to be there for part of television history. And so I went out with a proposal to publishers, and I got just about as far as you'd expect me to get, which was nowhere. No one was interested because nobody remembered who Mr. Magoo was. Nobody remembered the special, and it was Christmas, so it means it would really sell once a year, which I have to say they were accurate about that. It really sells big time for about 3 months of the year and not for the rest. But they were wrong about the first two, because there is a huge following for this special because of its heart. I mean, people really take those songs to heart, and it has been, like you say, a big part of their lives since they first saw it. And that's going on, it's 50 years this month, in fact, in a few days. So it was a pleasure to do. It was fun to do. It was fun to put this all the pieces together and connect all these dots. And then it was very well received. You know, it did well with people in the animation community. It did well with the fans of the special. It's still selling well. It's had two printings, which is more than you'd expect for a book that nobody would touch, and which I did have to. I had to learn the hard way how to publish a book.
Sure.
So I did publish the book. It's almost sold out of its second printing. With the 50th anniversary, I was talked into doing a special commemorative edition of the book. It's about another 50 pages longer and quite almost double the number of illustrations. And it's only 250 copies, but it's selling well too. So clearly there's a market out there for this, and clearly it has hit a lot of people right where it really matters, you know?
Yeah, I actually know several people who have had a lifelong affection for this film. And I met a guy when I worked in Atlanta who had taken the script, had recorded it on audio like I did, took the entire script, made a play out of it, and performed it at his grammar school
Wow.
9 years old.
Wow.
And somehow managed to do the songs. I don't know how faithfully rendered they were, but
right.
But they did them.
So. Yeah.
But yeah. Well, the music to me is the big difference between Magoo's Christmas Carol and really everything else. Because even the great Disney films, which have great songs and so forth, they didn't have people like Julie Stein and Bob Merrill, who were big-time Broadway composers. I mean, this is completely off the charts for basically a limited animation one-off TV special.
It is, and I give a lot of credit to Leora Gill for aiming high. I mean, going right to the top, I'm going to get Richard Rodgers to do this. Really? That's amazing. Although, if you put it in context, it was a little less amazing simply because he'd already done Cinderella on TV just
sure.
a couple years before. So he was familiar with doing that kind of thing and reinventing it for the new medium. But he aimed high, and by gosh, he got it. You know, with Stein and Merrill, he really hit it. And, you know, over the years, people would kind of rag on Bob Merrill for some cutesy lyrics and stuff like that. But there aren't any cutesy lyrics. I mean, he knocks it out of the park with Alone in the World. That is really
a
gut
song.
Punch.
Yeah.
You know, that one really hits everybody. And even Lord's Bright Blessing, what a great
sure.
Recounting of the spirit of Christmas. You know, he really, really nailed it. And Stein's tunes are just wonderful.
And Winter is Warm. Is a
Winter
great
is Warm.
Song. I mean,
and it's great. It becomes the centerpiece of the story, really.
Yeah.
It's a great – I mean, these guys were very thoughtful about what they did. They weren't looking at this and saying – oh, animation, let's just craft something out if we can get back to our real job.
Now, why didn't the soundtrack ever come out? Did they just not feel like it was warranted?
There's no clear explanation that I can find for that. They were going to do some promotional pressings, and they got everything ready. They got all the releases done. They were going to do Timex was going to put out, you know, like 3,000 copies of a promotional soundtrack, and for some reason it just stopped. I don't know if it had something. I doubt that it had anything to do with the songwriters, but it could have. Nothing exists in their file saying that they were opposed to anything like that. And of course, the more that kind of stuff comes out, the more they're going to make off the publishing. So nobody has ever figured out exactly why it didn't happen. They even did a test pressing of a storybook record for children, which has much of the same material on it. That didn't happen either. And for years and years, that's been one of the most sought-after soundtracks, is the songs from Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Well, I don't remember when the last time you showed it at the Egyptian, maybe 2 years ago,
It was 2 years ago, yeah.
But I had already read your book by then, and I saw it at both the Arrow presentation and at the Egyptian. And I remember that day sitting there with my wife waiting for the show to start, and suddenly this music comes over the speakers in the Egyptian. And at first I thought, what is that? And then I realized it was the overture.
It was the overture.
Which I had never heard, and I burst into tears. This is 2 years ago, but I burst into tears because I had heard about it. I knew it existed. I had never heard it in my life. And then, boom, there it is.
Yep.
And it's wonderful.
Yep.
And it so annoys me that they cut it on the Blu-ray, that it's partly there.
It's mostly there. There's just a little bit cut out for time.
Yeah. It still bugs me.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, glad to have what's
there. And, you know, it's a shame because that thing literally was lost for almost 50 years. Nobody had heard it since it was recorded.
Where did you find it, if you can say?
They found it in the vault. It was just sitting there, and I'm not quite sure. Nobody's quite sure exactly what its purpose was, because it certainly wouldn't – it would take up too much screen time to put it in an hour slot.
Yeah.
We can only guess that it was part of a proposed soundtrack. But again, the soundtrack never happened. Or was he just covering his bases to do it, make sure that he had the whole thing? Was it going to be something else later? Nobody knows.
They never flirted with doing it theatrically or doing an expanded version or anything like that, did they?
No. No, nobody knows. It was recorded at the time. So,
yeah.
But nobody knows why. And it's out of all the things that have been accomplished by having done this book, you know, we got the book came out. We got a new mastering of the film, the bonus features, the overture, the sheet music. All the things that have come from this thing have been great. The last thing that we're trying to knock off is a CD soundtrack. Maybe it'll be a digital soundtrack rather than CD, but we're trying very hard to do that. But part of this new edition of the book was supposed to be a soundtrack CD included with it. And I had all the permissions in place. Everything was going to go. And then when they went to dig in the vaults, couldn't find them. Couldn't even find the mixed music and effects tracks. Couldn't find the quarter inches, the 35mm dubbing units. Couldn't find anything. I said, that's odd, because I don't believe that those would have been lost. They're probably misplaced or mislabeled. But nevertheless, we couldn't do it in time for this 50th anniversary, which is very disappointing. But it's still being worked on. We still hope to dig through there. If the materials can be found, we would do a soundtrack, and it would include the overture, the final versions of the songs, because the songs that were released on iTunes were actually the raw versions. Mm. They didn't have the final mixes with the choral overdubs and stuff like that. I want Walter Scharf's soundtrack or score on there, because that's a key part of the emotional impact
of
that
film.
And I'd like to put on the Stein and Merrill demos, because that was an amazing find in itself. You know, just out of all these records, that when I went to interview the Leviteau family, they had all these old records.
This is the family of Abe Leviteau,
who was the director of the film. And so I was talking to the daughters, and they showed me all of these records they had, and they are from different films and different commercials and stuff like that. And they had these ones from Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, and said, well, we should get those transferred and just see what's on them. And then it turned out that one of them was the demos of all the songs from Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol sung by Stein and Merrill.
Wow.
Mostly Merrill with Stein playing the piano. It's like, wow, how has this been lost for all this time? And as far as anybody knows, it's the only copy that exists of their demos. But there they are. They're belting their hearts out singing this stuff. Amazing find.
Now, some of that is on the Blu-ray.
Yeah, there is. I think there's Ringle is on, yeah. Is on the Blu-ray. But they did all the songs.
Wow.
And we'd like to put those out on the soundtrack, too.
I want this soundtrack.
Me, too.
Yes. Get that done. Yeah, Walter Scharf's incidental music is also wonderful. And God knows how many times I've seen this thing. But probably not as many as you, but... I'd say
probably
in
just
excess
as many.
Of 100 times,
yeah.
You know? And so it's gotten to the point where I know the incidental music almost as well as I know the songs. And the whole opening sequence, when it first goes in, you hear the French horn doing the Winter is Warm theme, and then the orchestra comes in with the choral music. It's wonderful. I mean,
it is.
No Broadway show ever had an oomph any better than that to open the thing. And then at the end, when Magoo is pleading his case on his grave as the ghost of Christmas future is threatening him, that kind of stark medley of Christmas carols that's playing under it is just really effective and just beautifully orchestrated and all this wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it's really a solid part of the track. And the funny thing about it is, if you read Scharf's autobiography, he never mentions it.
Wow.
In fact, he doesn't even include it in his filmography at the end.
How very strange.
Yeah, I don't think he thought a lot of it, and probably because Stein and Merrill had done the core music that he worked off of. But, you know, Irwin Costa won an Academy Award for working off the Sherman Brothers score. So I was a little bit surprised that he would look down his nose at that. But
yeah.
it just doesn't come off for him.
Do you suppose it was just such a quickie project in some ways? Or, I mean, it's...
I think you could argue that. But as I recall, I'd have to go back and check his autobiography. But I think he even had Uncle Sam Magoo on there, which is not nearly the caliber of...
No.
Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
That's just got to be an oversight or something, don't you think? Or
you could argue that,
yeah.
But there's a picture of him with Jim Backus standing next to him while he's conducting the session in that book, and he doesn't identify the session. I just thought it was, what? You go to trouble to take a picture out of your files and you put it in there and then don't put a caption on it? Well, this was just me recording with some guy, you know?
Now, speaking of Stein and Merrill, before we move away from them, there's always been the rumor that they presented people as a song for Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Yeah, which makes for a great story, but unfortunately
but it can't
it's
be
not
true.
No, it's not true.
Where do you think that got started?
Hank Saperstein.
Ah.
Hank Saperstein liked to tell a good story, and so he told a good story, and unfortunately with the internet, it just went crazy, and now everybody believes that, you know. But I talked directly to... Leora Gill's widow, Lee, and I asked her about that, and she said, no, it was a coincidence because they were working on Funny Girl at the exact same time as they were working on this, and the Leora Gill family heard that song, and they thought, this is great, but they said, no, this isn't for you. This is for Ray Stark on the Fanny Bryce project we're working on, so sorry. But it was never offered up to him, and they rejected it. I mean, that sounds apocryphal to say, oh, we almost had this great song that would have made us a million, you know. But they didn't almost have it because it was never intended
for
them.
And would it have made them a million if they had had it?
Exactly, because they didn't promote anything off of that soundtrack.
Because there's a lot of good songs in that thing that they didn't do anything with.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So had people been in Magoo's Christmas Carol, it might have just
been obscured.
Known only to us.
Yeah.
Now, whose idea was it to do this in the first place? I ask as though I've never read your book.
Well, the idea was Leora Gill's. He came into the studio, and he was director of development for new projects there. And being a shrewd man, he looked at what assets that place had, and one of the assets they had was Mr. Magoo. So how can I turn this into something else? And the other asset they have is Gerald McBoing Boing. So he combined the two. And like I say, he picked up A Christmas Carol, probably because Oliver, which was a Broadway hit. Well, I wouldn't say Broadway. It actually started in London, but it was a big hit. So, look, we made a musical of a Dickens property. Let's try another musical of a Dickens property. And to make matters even more crazy, let's throw in Mr. Magoo and Gerald McBoing Boing, which, like I say, on the surface, you just go, how on earth did that happen? It doesn't even make sense. And yet it makes perfect sense with what happened, you know. And I have to say, it's incredible that NBC looked at that and said, yeah, we can do that. And maybe it was because Mr. Magoo was still marketable at the time. And so let's take that and a musical Dickens property and smash them together. And it could have been just as bad as it sounds, but it actually was amazing.
They they tinkered with Dickens just a little bit here and there.
Yep.
Switched two of the ghosts. So we have Ghost of Christmas Past.
Comes first.
Comes first. And but to good effect, because it's it introduces one of the great songs of All Alone in the World, which is such a touching
piece. Very touching.
But as I said before, and when they presented this as a possible project, they say, okay, we got Mr. Magoo, we got Gerald McBoing Boing, so let's make this version of A Christmas Carol. Surely everybody in the room thought, okay, it'll be a funny Christmas Carol. So how did it not become that?
Again, I think it goes to Orgel's taste. His whole idea was to tell it as a straight story. And if you watch it, there's very few Magoo gags in it. And it's mostly at the very end there when he looks at that bust and says, oh, what I forgot to put my outdoor clothes on. And he puts those on and goes out. But by and large, there's very few nearsighted gags in the film, which is really who he was at that point.
Sure. They leave that to the opening, the Broadway opening and closing.
Yeah, it's all about the Broadway stuff. And there were some bits that were cut out of it when you come back from the play after before going to a commercial. You show him backstage getting undressed and doing whatever he does with his backstage stuff between acts. But that was all cut out, and I think it works fine without them. But that was where the humor was going to come. And I think it was trying to answer those who knew Mr. Magoo from the cartoons and those who wanted to tell a straight story. So that way you can kind of mash them together and make everybody a little bit happy. But a lot of even Dickens fans think this is one of the more faithful tellings of the story.
It is. At least it's a very respectful telling.
It is.
And let's talk about some of the voice talent. For years, and I don't know that I can identify him anywhere else in the film except for the one line. I know that Maury Amsterdam is one of the voices, but the only time I can hear his voice
is that one line.
How did he die? And that's the only thing I hear. Is he in this thing anywhere else?
No, he's in Orgel's original script. He's in there as another one of the bankers there on the street. But after some research and study on it, it sounds more like it's Les Tremaine doing that other voice. So it was John Hart, Maury Amsterdam, and Les Tremaine. Probably because Maury couldn't separate enough from himself, would be my guess. So Maury gets that one line. Maury was a family friend of the Orgels. It wasn't like, hey, let's go get a guy from Dick Van Dyke to really put this over the top. He just happened to be a family friend of theirs, and Lee had used him on Gay Paris as the French narrator, so why not bring him back for this one?
Yeah. How did the other voices come in, like Jack Cassidy, Jane Keane, those people?
Nobody knows for sure on some of those because they're gone now and they can't tell us how they got that. Jack Cassidy was kind of between hits, I guess, or in a low spot in his career. So it was perfect timing. In fact, Shirley Jones was very happy that this gig even happened for him, and she was very grateful to Lee for having used Jack in it. And I think, I don't know if you could have come up with a better person to do that role. I mean, he really, really sounds like this everyman. He's perfect for the role. But yeah, and after that, his path started to go up pretty quickly too, winning some Tony Awards and stuff like that. Jane Keane had known Julie Stein and was working on some other project with him years back. And so she thinks that's how she was, you know, it was an old relationship with Julie. The cartoon voices were cartoon voices, and they'd both been working with Lee Orgel on Gay Paris, like Paul Frees and Joan Gardner. Of course, Jim Backus is the starring role.
Sure.
There's an interesting anecdote about Jim Backus as far as the singing goes. When Lee first proposed it, he wasn't so sure that Jim could handle it. He wasn't sure he had the chops to do the songs. And so he was actually looking at Robert Goulet to sing Magoo's part, because he just used Robert Goulet, and again, in Gay Parade. And I can understand his looking at that as a kind of an insurance policy, but boy, would that have been a real shock to hear Robert Goulet's voice coming out of Mr. Magoo. So I think cooler heads prevailed on that one. And Jim actually did a great job with the emotion on it. I mean, he's really touching in Alone in the World.
Sure, yeah. He's by no stretch of the imagination is he a singer.
No.
But he comes across perfectly. I mean, there are those musical roles inhabited by people who don't sing that well. And
Rex Harrison being a good example,
But he certainly makes it work. And yeah, and Ringle Wrangle. I mean, he does it perfectly. So that's
and it's a caricatured voice. It's not like he's even singing in his own voice.
Yeah.
He's got to put something on and still hit the notes and give it emotion, which is a pretty good trick.
Yeah. How long did it take him to make this?
Not very long. It really took him about 6 months, which is kind of astonishing. You know, TV has always been a real breakneck pace, you know. And they couldn't really start doing a lot of stuff until they had the songs in place. I think they started doing storyboards alongside of that process, but until they even nailed who was going to do the songs, which was not clear up front either, they had to just start working blindly. And those Steinmetal demos were probably used by the storyboard artists to start storyboarding those song sequences. But the music was recorded in April, and the show was ready for air in November. So that's a very short amount of time to turn out 52 minutes of screen time.
It sure is, yeah. Is that the final running time, 52 minutes? That seems short for 1962 hours.
Well, figure it was 26 minutes for a half hour in those days.
Yeah.
Nowadays it's 22. Yeah. So when you see A Christmas Carol broadcast this year, it will be truncated.
Yeah, it's going to be on NBC,
December 22nd at 8 p.m. So 50 years after its debut on NBC, it's coming back.
And, yeah, it's going to have to be cut.
Yep.
Because an hour now is not what an hour was 50 years ago. You know, when I've seen it in syndication over the years, as I'm sure you have, they'll just normally just cut off the Broadway opening and closing, which pretty neatly gives them the commercial time that they want.
Yeah. It does. It doesn't explain why those people are sitting in the theater.
No,
but
no. But I wonder if that's what NBC is going to do as well, because it seems almost preferable to cutting something out of the story itself. That would, and if they were to cut out a song, that would be awful.
It would be.
I mean, I could lose Great to Be Back on Broadway before I could lose
Lord's Bright Blessing or anything. Alone in the World,
you couldn't. I mean, and if they were to lose Winter Is Warm, then the whole heart of the thing is gone.
Kind of gone, yeah. So. But you know, they did cut that one pretty routinely too.
Yeah.
Which is rather stunning to me. You know, between speeding it up slightly and cutting the two bookends, they might be able to make it work.
Yeah. Well, as for me, I don't know that I'll watch it on NBC. I might watch it just out of allegiance to kid me.
Right.
Seeing it the first time. But I think I would be so annoyed by whatever they would do with it. I think I'm just going to stick with my Blu-ray, which is gorgeous.
Well, yeah, why not, you know? Yeah. But, to me, the best – I'm completely on board with not cutting it, but I understand the reality.
Sure.
To me, the best thing is that for the first time in a long, long, long time, a new generation will be exposed to the special. And hopefully it will breed more fans of the special and people understanding just how great this really was.
Yeah, there's something about the style of it as well that doesn't much look like any kind of animation that's out now, but I would think it would be captivating even to kids. Because we were talking about UPA earlier in its modernistic style. Magoo's Christmas Carol is certainly made in that style so that everything is kind of angular, a stylized. Little bit stylized. To me, the great image of how that animation was done is in the Winter is Warm sequence when the character of Belle is walking over toward the window giving her a little talk, and her skirt is simply two different cone shapes.
Just moving in and out.
Just move in and out.
Yep.
And it gives a great illusion of her walking, but it's an incredibly simple illusion that is not realistic in any way, shape, or form.
But it works. Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. And I think one of the great things about this film, and I would say a lot of the best UPA, is that the use of color is so vivid.
It is, but you know, for a long time you couldn't have even told that, because the transfers that you got on your first DVD, or on LaserDisc or VHS, were from a faded print. So it's very hard to see just how beautiful those colors were. And when you finally see, I mean, it was eye-opening to me when I found backgrounds from the thing, and I went, "Wow, that's not what I've been looking at," you know. And when I first saw it, it was in black and white, so I really wasn't what I was looking at. And then when they went back in and went back to the negative to make this latest transfer for Blu-ray, there's a lot of richness in there, and it really sings when you see it properly viewed.
Yeah, that's when Turner Classic Movies showed that evening of animation a few weeks ago that Jerry Beck helped host.
Mm-hmm.
They did a whole segment on UPA, and that's the first time I'd seen some of those things, but there was uniform right across the board that the color use was really striking. And even my 16mm print was pretty nice. It was very beautiful. But I probably didn't see it in color until the 70s, maybe.
Probably.
Maybe the late 70s, because I didn't have a color TV. I didn't have a TV for the longest time when I was in my 20s, you know,
yep.
I just didn't even have a TV. And so the next time I got around to watching it, it's on my own color television. That was quite an eye-opening experience, because it looked fine to me at that time.
Yep.
But this is such a special picture. It led to a whole series of Magoo appearing in classic stories. How in the world did that happen? Was this more successful than they thought it was going to be, and they thought, here's a good way to cash in on it?
Yes. Yes, it got huge ratings, and it beat everything in its time slot, and it did even better the second year. And they had been toying with the idea, let's do something else with Magoo, because this really worked very well for us, for the sponsor and for the network, so let's do something else with it. So they started doing some research, seeing how people responded to Mr. Magoo, and it was all very favorable, one of the most recognized characters at the time. And they weren't quite sure what to do with it, and they went in a couple of different directions. They even were looking at it as maybe Jay Ward writer, Chris Jenkins, I think, had proposed doing it like a James Bond thing with Mr. Magoo. But the most obvious one, and the one that they finally settled on, was, wait, this was classic literature. Why don't we just do some more of classic literature? Only now we'll make it half the length and cut out the songs. So when you get some of these 400-page books and they've been cut down to 26 minutes, it's a lot of story to jam in there. And so it gets a little dialogue heavy, because you just got to hit all the story points as fast as you can. That being said, they are a little talky, but they do have some great visuals in them. And for a lot of kids of that generation, it was their first exposure to classic literature.
Yeah, I remember them very well. And I've never seen them since, though, so I have no idea.
They are out on DVD now.
Are they?
Yeah.
Because I remember watching them, and oddly enough, I remember the Moby Dick one best of all for some reason. But it was up my alley, and I liked reading as a kid, so it struck me as being the best of both worlds of introduction to books and characters that maybe I hadn't yet come across.
Yep.
But now, just to be clear, it's going to show on NBC on December 22nd.
Yep.
But the actual first showing was December 18th, right?
That's correct.
So have you got a special commemorative 50th anniversary evening planned?
I wish I had, but I don't really this time. Five years ago, we did do a special gathering where I brought all the surviving cast and crew together for dinner over at the Smokehouse, which was next door to the UPA studio, which is no longer there. And that was kind of our big blowout, and economic times being what they are, I don't think we can quite pull that off again. But I do plan to talk to some of these people who are still around that worked on it. And there'll be an interesting blog post coming up next week based on the fact that it's the 50th.
Yeah. How many survivors are there now of the production?
There are only two actresses left, Marie Matthews and Jane Keane. Mm-hmm. And there are probably 5 or 6 artists that are still around.
Marie Matthews was young Scrooge.
She was young Scrooge. Right? She did not actually have a speaking role in the film, but she sang for young Scrooge and was pressed in the service to sing for the Cratchit daughter.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I saw she was at the Egyptian screening. Was she at the Arrow screening as well?
Yeah.
And Jane Keane was
there too.
There as well. Yeah. So, did you interview other voice actors who are no longer with us? Did you get to anybody else?
I did talk to Laura Olsher because she was still around. She just died this last summer. But that was it. Everybody else was gone by then.
Yeah.
John Hart is still alive, but he's not in great shape and didn't remember. I talked to his wife, and he didn't remember a thing about having worked on it. And why would he? He's only got one line in it. I mean, yeah. He recorded several lines for several different characters, but only one made it into the final film.
Well, even the ones who survive, did Jane Keane and Marie Matthews have that many memories of? I mean, it had to be just a day or so.
Well, that's it. That's the thing is, when I started doing this, I'm talking to these people about this thing that happened for one day 50 years ago. How much can they remember, really? You know, how much can you remember from one day 50 years ago? But it was surprising how much they did remember, and Marie Matthews had very clear recollections of it. Mostly because it was supposed to be her son who got the gig, but they weren't happy with any of the little boys they were listening to. And Marie's mother was a singing and casting person, and she convinced Scharf to try Marie out. She says, my daughter can sing like a little boy. You'll love it. And they got like, oh, yeah, right. But they got Marie in front of the mic, and she did exactly what they were looking for, so she got the gig and her son didn't. But and the thing is, because of something like that, that she would have such strong recollections.
Sure. Well, didn't all the cast record pretty much at the same time anyway?
Yeah, for the songs, they were all there. The only one that was not there, because she did hers alone, was Jane. Mm-hmm. Jane Keane recorded by herself. But the others were all there for the various songs for that. They recorded them all in one day, like from 8 in the morning to 11 at night.
Wow.
That's a long day.
That really is a kind of astonishing when you really get down to it. Now, you said Jane Keane recorded separately, but was it that same day, just at a different time? Or
that's one thing I need to call her and ask her, because that one I'm not clear on. I know she did do it separately, and it's possible that she did it on an entirely different day, because it would have been odd for her to just walk in and walk out with all those other people standing around.
They recorded that in Burbank, right?
No, actually it was down at the Goldwyn lot in Hollywood.
Oh, I knew that, and for some reason I was thinking, yeah, sorry.
No, the UPA was in Burbank,
yeah.
And they did all of the auditions at the UPA studio in Burbank. But the actual recording of the songs was down in Hollywood at the Goldwyn lot, and the dialogue was recorded at Writer Sound down on Vine.
It's the building where they recorded it is now, don't they do 3D imagery or something?
Yes, it's a 3D conversion facility.
But the building's still there. So the
building is still there.
It's still got Ghost of Mr. Magoo voices in the hallway somewhere.
And the stage where they recorded the songs is still there, although it's no longer a scoring stage, which it was at the time. It's now a shooting stage.
Oh. Well, before we wrap up, you mentioned Jay Ward a while ago, and Jay Ward is going to be the subject of your next project, right?
That's correct. The next book is The Art of Jay Ward Productions. Excuse me. And that came about because there was a lot of UPA artists that worked on Christmas Carol. I mean, back and forth between UPA and Jay Ward. There were artists who worked all the time between the two studios. When one was quiet, they'd go pick up work at the other and vice versa. And most of Jay Ward's staff was made of former UPA people. And so there was a lot of crossover there. And when I started looking through the papers and artwork for this one artist who had worked on both of them, worked at both studios, I said, you know, these drawings are pretty cool. I don't think most people realize how good the art was on these things because it was animated in Mexico. So what they saw on the screen was nothing like what the artists were drawing here, you know.
Wow.
And there's quite a wide variety of it. I said, you know, I think there might be a book here because this is fascinating to see. So I proposed the book to Classic Media and to Jay's daughter, Tiffany, and they're both entities were behind it. And so it'll be coming out next November, October, November, in time for the DreamWorks Peabody and Sherman film.
Oh, that's great. Because the Jay Ward stuff is also, I think it's one of the shining lights of 60s animation. And
which is ironic because the animation isn't very good.
No, it is not.
But it is funny.
Yeah, it's the scripts are so great. And the animation works exactly like it should for what they're doing.
For what they're doing, yeah.
But that's some of the funniest stuff ever.
Yep.
And it remains as funny as it ever was.
Yeah. It's just, and people respond very well when you tell them that this project is coming. They all want to see that book.
Yeah, I love Jay Ward stuff, so I'll be the first to buy it. And, you know, as close to the first as I can get.
As you can get, yeah.
But my wife was doing a crossword puzzle the other day, and she said, "What was the name of Sherman and Peabody's time machine?" And I said, "It was the Wayback Machine." She said, "Well, that doesn't fit." And I said, "Well, that's what it was. It was the Wayback Machine." She said, "No, it's five letters."
That's how you spell it.
And I never knew that till 2 days ago.
It's
W-A-B-A-C.
Yeah. It's a takeoff on UNIVAC.
Yeah. I never knew that. I always just thought it was the Wayback.
Yeah, people still misspell it in books and stuff, but yeah, that's funny.
So I'm glad to know I'm still capable of learning new things.
No matter how useless the information is.
It is. Totally useless. But if I'm ever writing about Sherman and Mr. Peabody, then I'll spell that right.
Especially if you get another crossword puzzle.
Well, before we wrap up, you have a website.
I do.
For which we can look at samples of the book and order the book.
Yep, MrMagoo'sChristmasCarol.com. And if you're really a nut for the special, I have a blog too, MrMagoo'sChristmasCarol.blogspot.com, there are archives on that going back over the last several years, and it deals with anything to do with the special and UPA. And it will gradually transform in this next year to the Jay Ward material. But I would encourage people to check it out. There's a lot of interesting information, stuff that I couldn't fit into the book sometimes.
Oh, great. Yeah, I've read many of those blogs. And as I say, I've had this book since the week it was published, and it's terrific. And I deeply regret that I didn't write it myself, although
some other poor sucker had to do it.
Yeah. When I think about all the books that I did write and have sold no copies, then I'm sure you did better than I would have done under the same circumstances.
It's no easy business.
And certainly you wrote it better than I ever would have, and you had, because it's beautifully done. And
well, thank you.
I like everything about it.
Thank you.
So I'm telling everybody listening to this to buy this book. Is it just called The Making of Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol? What's it called?
It's Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas Special.
That's what I said, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much. This has been so great. I've been looking forward to talking to you about this for a long time.
Well, thank you, Frank. This has been great.
I sure hope you enjoyed that conversation with Daryl Van Sitters. I sure did. And I would have talked with him for about 3, 4, 7 more hours if I was not sitting in a boardroom at his office during his work day. There were actually people outside still doing the job, and so I felt a little sheepish about taking him away just to talk about this. So I made it easy on him, but I'm going to have him back someday, and we're going to talk more about this. And then when he finishes the Jay Ward book, I definitely want to talk to him about that because I loves me some Jay Ward. So I will post the links to his website, MrMagoo'sChristmasCarol.com, and his blog, MrMagoo'sChristmasCarol.blogspot.something. Well, he just said it, and it's going to be on my link page. Again, I should really listen to these things again before I start yakking. And also, I will have a link to the book, and there's also a 50th anniversary special super duper version of it that's in a slipcase and everything, and it's gorgeous. And I think you can also still buy copies that are autographed not only by Daryl but by several members of the cast and crew. So if you go to his website, you can see a lot of that kind of thing and maybe order directly from him. But you would be doing me a real solid if you would go through my website, hit Amazon.com, and order it there. Because then not only will Daryl be happy to have sold books, but I will be happy because Amazon will have given me some kickback. And while you're there and in the Christmas spirit, might I recommend AMC's The Great Christmas Movie is a great book by Mr. Frank Thompson. He's a fine guy, and he really deserves all the help we can give him and all the love we can give him. So send your love his way. And while you're at it, send some money his way by buying his books. So this has been a fun episode of the commentary track for me. We will try it again next week and try to have some fun on some other subject. I'm pretty sure I know what it is, but why say it now if it can still fall through? So look forward to it next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.